This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now today, Friday, there's a very important meeting due to take place in Brussels. David Frost, or Lord Frost as they call him, the British negotiator with the European Union on Brexit, is going to meet Maros Sefcovic, who is the Vice President of the European Parliament or the European Commission and has taken over from Michel Barnier as the EU representative in those talks. This morning and yesterday in the House of Lords, Frost rejected the idea that he was softening his approach and his tone, something that Sefcovic had suggested earlier in the week. It's a massive meeting and there are massive stakes in play here. The Northern Protocol is the issue, and if Britain were to unilaterally act and disregard it, we would be in serious trouble. And it's now, 43 years since Britain, 47 years, I think, since Britain joined the European Union. All of that time, it has caused trouble for Tory leaders. Ted Heath, the Prime Minister who took Britain into the European Union in 1973, was never forgiven. Theresa May has fallen. David Cameron has fallen most spectacularly when he lost the referendum in 2015. About whether or not Britain should leave. The consequences keep rolling, and one has to ask, has Brexit been worth it, particularly when you look at the chaos in Britain over the last 6 or 8 weeks? And we're joined now by Chris Johns, former chief economist with the Bank of Ireland. Chris is now a respected commentator, and he joins us to talk about Brexit and whether it has delivered on its promise. Chris, thanks for joining us. And not that you need reminding, but let's remind ourselves of the promises. There would be a new global Britain. They would be free of diktats from Brussels and the European Court of Justice. It would be the dawn of a new era, and Britain would expand and find its rightful place in the world. And everything would be great, of course, economically as well. Many in the business community, Chris, didn't believe this. And the most notable and interesting opponent of Brexit was the Financial Times, a very good newspaper, but the newspaper of business. So we're 10 months in or thereabouts since 1st of January 2021. How's it going?
It's not going well, Eamon. And I think everybody knows that. There's different ways of looking at it. You can look at the big picture from the top down, or you can look at it from the perspective of the individual business from the bottom up. The thing about that top down view is that the government can get away with saying that the obvious problems in the big picture data, the fact that the economy isn't growing as fast as some of its European neighbours and other big numbers, macro numbers we call them, is that they can claim it's the pandemic. And that yes, they can say the reason why this is happening in a way that we didn't expect, it's all down to the pandemic, it's got nothing to do with Brexit. The other thing that they've done in terms of the big picture is that they have moved the goalposts. Most notably, Dominic Cummings has joined this particular bandwagon, which yes, they've all been at. And he said the other day when he's got a quite infamous blog now, and he said, just wait, when the euro collapses in 10 to 15 years' time, you'll see that I was right. Brexit was worth it. So yeah. Both pushing the time that it's going to take to judge it, which is something that you know that Rees-Mogg did a couple of years ago. They've all been at this time thing, pushing it out and out. And now the definition of success is not being part of the euro when it collapses, which is a very different perspective to the sunny up plans that the Leave campaign pushed during the course of the referendum campaign and indeed in the run-up to the last general election. From the bottom up, though, they can't get away with it. It's when you look at the individual companies, the individual businesses, the sectors that are being the hardest hit. We've heard a lot about fishing, for example, and that hasn't gone away. That is still as bad as it ever was. If you try importing a petunia from Holland, Holland produces a lot of plants and bulbs for the UK market, and the pieces of paper that you have to fill out, the bureaucracy that you have to go through, is causing a lot of people, frankly, to give up. Slow down. And so those stories are building. And eventually, you know, the old cliche is that the plural of anecdote is not data. In this case, it actually is. And eventually we're building up that data. But it's the mixing up of the pandemic and Brexit that I think is the thing that gets the headlines. Those micro stories appear in the Financial Times, but not in the Daily Mail. So there is a difference in perception. But it is adding up to a wee bit of buyer's remorse to the extent that opinion polls can be paid attention to. And they come heavily caveated, of course. We still ask the British people, what do they think of Brexit? And the answer is that there's an increasing number. It's not a massive majority or anything, but there is an increasing number to the point where it is a small majority now regret it.
Yes.
And that's important, I think. And that does actually feed into the thing that you mentioned about Lord Frost, because one of the things that happens we've seen this week all the stories about the Northern powerhouse going off the rails and people expressing a bit of buyer's remorse there, is that we had Dominic Raab on the TV the other day when asked, can Johnson be expected to fulfill any of his promises? Can he be trusted? And Rob echoes something that other ministers have done over the course of the last while and said, well, of course he can be trusted. He got Brexit done. And this is the single transferable answer to everything that is thrown at this yes. government. Now, when they are asked about their failures, when they are asked about their broken promises, when they are asked about corruption, they talk about Brexit. And increasingly, they look ridiculous when they do it, but they continue to do it. Now, the link with the Frost thing here is, of course, is that if the Northern Ireland Protocol is junked via Article 16 being invoked, that is the opposite to Brexit being done. That is, in fact, Brexit being undone with the threat that it all gets reopened. And so the one thing that they've got, the one thing that they keep saying, no matter how ridiculous that they look, we got Brexit done, begins to unravel as well. So I think that goes some way, not all the way, but some way to explaining why there has been a softening in tone that we spoke about last week from Lord Frost.
Yes, and I mean, Brexit, going back to Edward Heath's time in 1973, and indeed if you go back almost forever, there's a visceral feeling in Britain about its great traditions and how different it is from Europe. Brexit, really, it's a manifestation of that visceral feeling rather than the use of the brain. That's how Johnson, first of all, captured the Tory party because he understood it and responded to it. And then he captured the nation with an 80-seat majority. So Brexit is going to be, wherever it leads the United Kingdom, it's going to be something hugely historic. It's a landmark, Chris, isn't it? The question we need to ask, is it a landmark for good or ill? Some people say it will take 50 years to decide that.
Yeah, I don't know how long it will take, but I do think the verdict of history will be unequivocal, that it was a bad thing, both for Britain and for Europe, and probably the world as well. Because going back to all of that stuff that you mentioned about Ted Heath and the other European enthusiasts of the 1960s and 1970s. These men, and they are often men, often had first-hand experience of war. And they knew that the reason why Europe had been put together in the ashes of the Second World War and the original visionaries behind the creation of what was to become the European Union, their primary objective, in some cases their only objective, was to stop European war, particularly war between Germany and France, into which so many other countries eventually got pulled. And that history goes back centuries, not just the 20th century, it goes back a long, long way. And so it was men like Ted Heath, Dennis Healy on the Labour side, a beachmaster at the Anzio landings in southern Italy, were passionate pro-Europeans for this reason and this reason alone. That seems very anachronistic and slightly strange to the present generation, but it was real for those men who are mostly all dead now, of course. And so that driving force behind European integration has started to fade, not least in Britain, but also elsewhere. So answering the question, what is Europe for in the current age where we don't go to war anymore with each other, has become harder. And it is a failing of the European Union that they can't provide us with a vision. And in particular, it was a failure of David Cameron and the Remain campaign generally. They were unable to articulate a very positive vision for Europe and instead just did Project Fear, which was that it's going to be dreadful if we leave, which is true. But I think something more was needed for the very reason that you gave us just now, is that the Leave campaign was an appeal to emotion rather than reason. I'm sure neuroscientists would say it's a left brain, right brain type thing or something like that. And so the emotion of Britain's glorious imperial past was a big part of it, invoking the spirit of the Second World War. Ironically, given all that I've said about military and warfare history, a lot of the people that argued for Leave campaign appealed to Britain's wartime isolationist spirit. Because Britain was never really a fully attached member of the European Union. This debate has been going on for years. Originally, it was the hard left of the Labour Party that opposed Europe. And that was because it regarded it as a capitalist club designed to do down workers. There are really weird ideas that have gone around in the UK for a long period of time, but that was quite prevalent in the Labour Party of the 1970s and indeed lingers in some quarters of the left to the present day. And then, of course, there's the right wing of the Tory party that hates Brussels and all things European for very nationalistic, nativist reasons. They do not like the federalist project that is Europe. And that's just, you know, the current incarnation of anti-European. That Britain is an island, was never invaded during the Second World War. All of these factors added up to a very different attitude towards Europe.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, Johnson gave Britain Brexit. You could also argue that Brexit gave Britain Johnson. Both propositions are true. Johnson is turning into a disaster, a liar. His latest two lies this week, there's going to be part of the levelling up project to level up the north of England and make it equal to the south and southeast. They were to get HS2, which is a high-speed train. There would be three sections. And lo and behold, yesterday they announced that two of those sections to Leeds would not be built. And, of course, the other lie, big lie, was to the unionist community and the loyalist community in the north, which the lie being that nothing would change when, in fact, something fundamental has changed for those people. The other series of lies he told and missteps he made involved sleaze and corruption, really, of Tory ministers and Tory politicians. One of them to the tune of Owen Paterson, a former Northern Secretary, ironically, to the tune of $500,000. He was lobbying on behalf of a company which, in fact, gained $6 million as a result of his lobbying. And the other issues around the NHS and the PPE is coming back to haunt Hancock, who also was lobbying. There is, it seems, corruption endemic. And Johnson tried to stop that by abolishing the committee in the House of Commons that oversees standards.
Yes. So lots going on there. And one of the things that he's done this week is row back from that and has said that, his words, not mine, I drove the car into the ditch.
Yes,
on that
he
one.
Said that last night to the 1922 committee, which is his own MPs.
Yes, and he's got a real problem with some of his MPs as a result of all of this. There's the ones that are genuinely worried by the evidence of this corruption. And so they applaud the fact that Johnson is now rowing back very, very hard and suggesting in various ways that MPs shouldn't be taking second jobs, consultancies and lobbying jobs, although it's becoming difficult to figure out just what he's saying. So there's the obvious corruption is one thing, but you mentioned HS2, which is a British railway plan that has been ongoing now for at least a decade, and the latest incarnation was announced this week, and it involved a lot of broken promises.
Yes,
and the reaction in the across the country has been, of course, very interesting, from local people in the north all the way through to Johnson's own MPs. That group again that we're talking about that are really worried by the direction that Johnson is going. And yesterday in the House of Commons, the chair of the Transport Select Committee, who is a Tory, talked about Johnson's perpetual promising of sunlight and delivering moonlight.
Yes.
As a code, not so coded way of saying all he ever does is tell lies, over promises and under delivers. Now, there's an interesting dynamic here, because I think that what Johnson says to himself, and this is revealed by the fact that he's done this throughout his entire career as an MP, as Mayor of London, as Foreign Secretary, Prime Minister, is that that's what he's always done. This is nothing new, and he has always gotten away with it. And I firmly believe that he believes I've always gotten away with it, and I'm going to get away with it again now. Time will tell. But he is in trouble with the senior backbenchers are now very, very worried about the direction that Johnson has taken the party and the government, as exemplified by this chair of the Transport Select Committee. If you'd have seen Johnson the other day in front of the Defence Select Committee, where he was having an argument with Tom Tugendhat, who is a very skilled politician, very steeped in the experience of the armed forces and defence spending. And Johnson was at his superficial best, accusing this Tom Tugendhat, who had this quite reasoned, you might agree or disagree, but very detailed exposition of defence spending in the UK and the way in which the different threats to the UK are evolving going forward in terms of cyber warfare and all the rest of it. And Johnson just said to him, we're not going to fight any more tank battles in Europe. It's not the Second World War. I mean, it was extraordinary in the way in which Johnson tried to dismiss this very sophisticated, erudite chair of the defence. And so it goes on. The
you
examples
to be a Tory.
Yes, perhaps, well, yes.
But a different type of Tory to the Spartans being these awful, ugly manifestations of Toryism who are all over the party now. They were elected in red wall seats, some of them. This is where the HS2 won't be going, and there might be fewer red wall seats next time out. But, I mean, there's a picture in front of me of David Frost, now Lord Frost, who is the embodiment of Spartanism, big mutton head on him, and denying in a negotiation that he was in any way softening his tone. And so he's off to Brussels today to try and make trouble for the European Union, and in particular for this country, Chris. And this is what I really want to ask you with your economist's hat on. The trade war is promised or threatened if they proceed along this road, which is really about appeasing the DUP, to whom they also lied. It's redeeming, if you like, the lie they made to the DUP that nothing would change as a result of Brexit. Something has, of course, changed. What will a trade war look like?
Oh, it would be dreadful, but it would come in stages. And the European response, as you say, it's a threat. It isn't a promise, but they have suggested that if Article 16 is junked, that they will take several steps, the ultimate one being junking the trade and cooperation agreement that was so painfully negotiated post the Brexit referendum that we are currently operating with, that has had some remarkable effects, actually. Because the CSO in Dublin this week showed that the value of your imports from Northern Ireland surged by 60% in the first 9 months of this year. And trade in the other direction has also gone up a lot, with a near 50% rise in exports to Northern Ireland. So cross-border trade on the island of Ireland, as a direct result of Brexit and the arrangement, the Northern Ireland Protocol, cross-border trade has surged. And from that economics perspective, that's a great thing. That shows you that this thing that we muttered about Northern Ireland having the best of both worlds, being a part of the UK single market and the EU single market, places it in a unique position. No other country, no other region has this benefit. And it could, and it already suggests it might be, a good thing for Northern Ireland. So far from complaining about it, I would say as an economist, you should probably celebrate it and say, for God's sake, keep it. But of course, it's the politics of it that are poisonous.
No, it's the constitutional position of Northern Ireland in relation to the United Kingdom that has changed in one very important respect. That goods going either way, east-west or west-east, have to go through a customs check when they come from the mainland, if we can call it that, into the north. And the same when they leave the north and go to the United Kingdom. The very fact that there are customs outposts or customs that have to be, they haven't been built, incidentally. Britain didn't build one piece of infrastructure to facilitate this, which gives you a clue as to whether they ever really meant it. That changes the status of Northern Ireland. It puts a line between them and the mainland, their homeland. And that is a real change.
It is and it isn't, Eamon, because they're
Hold on now. It is psychologically.
Psychologically it is.
And in terms of the Good Friday Agreement. Yeah,
but it's not the first time there have been checks on things going from the mainland, as you described it, to Northern Ireland. They've been between Great Britain and the North, there have been checks on stuff. They've been minor, they've been small, but over the years there have always been some. They've just not been very big, not very visible. But the principle of a check has been established, that ship sailed a long time ago.
Well, so, the principle of the Good Friday Agreement,
yes,
is the essence of the Good Friday Agreement is that Northern Ireland's status vis-a-vis the UK or the Republic will not change without the consent of the people of the North. Now, that's why the DUP are in trouble on the one hand, because they went along with this for Boris, who lied to them. And of course, it's also now why they are screaming the loudest, because they want to get back some credibility and some votes.
Yeah. Okay. So there's consent and there's consent, isn't there, Eamon? So Brexit itself was rejected by a majority of the people in Northern, yes, Ireland. They didn't consent to Brexit, did they? But they
well,
nevertheless
got it. They don't constitute an entity.
I know.
They are part,
yes,
of the United Kingdom. So that majority can't be invoked, I'm afraid, Chris, if you're a unionist or indeed if you're a moderate nationalist.
Okay. All right. So if you're going to take that fundamentalist principle that somebody has to consent to where the border is going to go in the North, then you have a fundamental impasse that will never be resolved. Because if you know as well as I do that the border has to go into the Irish Sea or it has to go onto the island of Ireland, and somebody is going to be upset over it.
Yes.
So if you're going to take a fundamentalist position on that, you're going to say that the position, the principle of consent is going to be violated whatever you do.
Well, arguably, there is no solution to
yeah,
this.
That's what I just said. There is no solution.
Yes. Well, yeah. But that was the case when,
yes,
the construct was first put together.
So therefore, you fudge it, don't you? And what you try to do is to say, okay, yeah, let's not be too principled about this and try to make it, in practical terms, as small a deal as we possibly can. That's what, yes, they did with the protocol. And as it turns out, everybody still shouts that it's not as small as it can be. And where we're at the moment is that the European Commission has responded to all of the David Frost and DUP type shouting and offered to cut the checks that are so bothering them all the way down to, and actually put it on a legal footing. They've offered to reduce them by 50% legally and enshrine that in law. And indeed, they have said that it could be up to 80%.
Yes, they have, yes.
So that the checks that they are so worried about could be de minimis. They won't go all together and asking the question, can you accept that? If you're going to stand on principle, you're just going to be run over, unfortunately.
At the heart of the Good Friday Agreement is the idea of constructive ambiguity.
Indeed.
And the constructive ambiguity required is breached, in my view, by Brexit and by the, even if there are any checks at all, and if Northern Ireland's position vis-a-vis the UK changes, I think they're right to say we haven't been consulted and this is being done without our consent. And therefore, as many right-wing Tories and the DUP say, this is a fundamental breach of the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, okay. Well, why not ask them? Why not actually, you know, we talk about referendums and polls and border polls and all the rest of it, and we talk about consent. Why not? If we asked the people of Northern Ireland, and in particular put those economic arguments that I put to you earlier on about the way in which cross-border trade is exploding and in the way in which the protocol could actually be very good for the economy, for business, and we actually asked the people of Ireland, which I do think some opinion pollsters are doing, we might be surprised by the answer. We might find that the majority of people in Northern Ireland actually do approve of the protocol, particularly in its amended form that the European Commission is now proposing. That may be one way around it. I haven't seen that argument made very often, but I don't understand, yes, why it isn't. Maybe the consent actually is there.
Well, maybe it is, but that would be the business community and people who have prospered from the fact that they can be part of the single market and at the same time have free trade with the UK. Just a final question, Chris. You were the first person to raise on this podcast and actually to trigger something in my own mind. Britain in and Johnson and the Tory party in its present, well, bedraggled state could do with a good row, couldn't they, with Europe and a real crisis involving Europe to take people's minds off their failure to govern and the shambles that is Westminster at the moment.
that shambles is really interesting. And that HS2 thing that we spoke about earlier on, the fundamental question of why are they doing it in this way has not really been asked in the British media over the last few days. And it's a very important question because it speaks to that shambles and sheds some light on what's going on elsewhere, particularly the row with Brussels. Because the reason why they have announced that they're not going to level up the North, which if you want to put it that way, that's what it amounted to this week, was a reneging on the big leveling up promise, is because of money. And that's the debate, or the row, if you like, between Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Johnson. And Sunak has won. The dead hand of the Treasury is all over this HS2 announcement. And what has happened is that the Treasury have told Johnson, the money isn't there. We haven't got enough cash for it. You're going to have to, row back on your promises. And interestingly, Johnson hasn't put up much of a fight when it comes to the money. That thing between number 11 and number 10 Downing Street that you and I have spoken about seems to have been won by Sunak and the Treasury. So now, a few weeks ago, when you and I were speaking about the protocol and what that meant, is that because of all these other things that are going on, the lack of money, the fact that the economy isn't doing so well, because there have been many other broken promises, another broken promise this week related to social care, and we could have done a whole podcast about that. There's just a litany of broken promises. And it looked like a row with Brussels in general, and the French in particular, would be the traditional time-honored way of A, deflecting attention from all of these broken promises and getting a few votes, or at least getting a few decent opinion polls ratings. I think that calculus has changed a little over the last few weeks, which is why I think that it was an edict actually from the cabinet to Frost. This is what's leaked this week, is that the cabinet have ganged up and for once and said, look, we can't have this row with Brussels. We can't go down this path that leads to a trade war. Because although superficially attractive from a headline point of view, we get the headlines, big row, big punch up with Macron, awful French, here we go again. We're gunboats in the channel, all that sort of thing. That's all good knockabout stuff for the opinion polls. But when we think it through, which for once they seem to have done, that this could lead to a full-blown trade war, the reopening of the entire Brexit deal, the only thing that they've got, which is to keep on saying, we delivered Brexit, and all of a sudden it unravels, that's an appalling vista from them. So that's why I think they have told Frost, they've told Johnson to tell Frost, back off, don't provoke this to the point where we get the trade war. And I think that's the interesting dynamic, is that having lost a lot of the backbenchers, the cabinet now is also on this particular issue standing up to Johnson. So, I mean, it might be motivated reasoning on my part, because I'd love to see this happen, Eamon, but I think that we are witnessing the beginning of the end of Johnson. It's going to take a long time, but I do think he is losing his party. It's the start of a very long process. It could well reverse itself, but at the moment, he's floundering, and he's floundering within his own party. And that was always going to be the danger. The danger isn't the British electorate. His majority is too big for that. The danger is his own party. And I think he's in a lot of trouble.
Yes, indeed. And that was confirmed, if you like, by the number of empty benches behind him, the size of the gaps at leaders' questions on Wednesday. Chris, as always, thank you very much for joining us from London. That's Chris Johns, former chief economist of the Bank of Ireland and now a commentator. And Chris and Jim Power, another contributor to the Stand, a very good contributor, another economist. They have their own podcast. It's called The Other Hand, and it's very, very good. So if you get an opportunity or you feel the needs of some economic solutions, that's where to go. We're grateful to Chris, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.